It turns out we lost the debate. And the voting was interesting. They polled the audience at the beginning of the debate as to what they thought of the question, and then they polled the audience at the end, and the side that changed the most minds won. So Mark and I lost. We failed to convince people that the threat of cyborg has been grossly exaggerated. Now, I thought a lot about this, you know, in the months afterwards. I mean, at first I blamed Mark, of course, right? I mean, I was perfect, and he, you know, that's why we lost. But I think it's a debate we are losing. That people don't believe the threat of cyber war is grossly exaggerated. And the cyber war hype is catching hold, and people are resonating with it. So I mean, so I had some great quotes, right? I had Mike McConnell himself say in the Washington Post, "The United States is fighting a cyber war today, and we're losing." Right? I had Senator Olympia Snow talk about Cyber Katrina. I had a newspaper headline about Cuba declaring cyber war. There's a great article from the Australian newspaper, The Independent. Hackers declare cyber war on Australia. Right? Hacking is cyber war is so easy, even kids can do it. Amit Yaron, cybersecurity advisor, said, and this is a great quote because it just makes fundamentally no sense, "Cyber 9/11 has happened over the last 10 years, but it's happened slowly so we don't see it." I don't even know what that means. I mean, there's lots of headlines about China. China declares war on Western search sites. So you can declare war on Google, which was interesting. Cyber war declared as China hunts for the West's intelligence secrets. Wall Street Journal had cyber blitz. So we had cyber 9/11, cyber Pearl Harbor, cyber Katrina. My favorite was cyber Armageddon. I mean, this is what gross exaggeration looks like. And it isn't just headline writers. I mean, actual, reasonable policymakers talk about cyber war, cyber threats in these very extreme terms. Right? And you know, you think about some of the examples of what we usually think of as cyber war, at least was portrayed in the media as cyber war. Estonia, April of 2007, Estonia was the victim of a variety of denial of service attacks. Despite what it said in the media, they weren't unprecedented in scope. They weren't, you know, nasty or bigger. They were like regular denial of service attacks. And this was at a time of ethnic tensions between Russia and Estonia, so Russia's to blame. Russia's never admitted it. The only person ever convicted of these attacks was actually a 22-year-old ethnic Russian living in Tallinn, who was objecting to a Soviet-era statue being pulled down. So like perhaps cyber war is so easy, even kids can do it. And the attacks themselves, I think, are interesting. I mean, you know, as war goes, this is pretty benign. It's like the enemy army lands on your shores, and they all run in front of you with a line in the post office. Right? That's a denial of service attack. Also 2007, this isn't talked about, but I think this is an example of what cyber war is more likely to look like. In October, Israel mounted an air attack against a nuclear research center in Syria. This was actually a real-life attack, not a cyber attack, like real-life planes dropping bombs. But as part of that, you know, we believe that Israel used cyber attacks to help disable air defense systems in Syria and neighboring countries. Right, so remember this when we talk about Stuxnet later. Also 2007 in Brazil, this was used as the centerpiece of a 60 Minutes article on cyber war. There was a series of blackouts in the country, blamed on extortionists. Again, no proof. There's one article in Wired that says it was sooty insulators and not a cyber attack at all. But you know, this was being used as an example of what cyber war looks like. August 08, Georgia. This is very similar to what happened in Estonia. The difference was this precipitated an actual land invasion. So there were, you know, tanks and troops going from Russia into Georgia. But before that, there was a series of cyber attacks, again, denial of service. And still, we don't know if this was state-sponsored or just, you know, kids playing politics. So the problem we had in the debate when we discussed whether the threat of cyber war has been grossly exaggerated is that there's no good definition of war in cyberspace. Right? We don't know when it starts. We don't know what it looks like. We don't know what it looks like when it's over. And it's not just the media. It's not just politicians. Even security experts don't have good definitions of these things. Right? Clearly, we are not fighting an actual war in cyberspace right now. Right? This is much more of a rhetorical war. Right? Like the war on terror, the war on crime. And this is, I think, a big difficulty we have. In America, we hate using the word war when there are actual wars, but we love using it when there's no war at all. Right? We like the war on crime, the war on poverty, the war on drugs. We're really big on rhetorical wars. And generally, we kind of know the difference. Right? The war on poverty, we're not actually driving tanks into poverty. Right? And the war in Iraq isn't about, you know, social policy. Well, I guess maybe it is. Never mind. Right? But here we are, and it started with the war on terror, and now cyber war, that the two are kind of blending. That yes, it's a rhetorical war, but there's kind of warlike stuff going on too. And that's confusing to people. Right? So if there's one thing to take away from this talk, this is the sentence. It's not that we're fighting a cyber war, but we're increasingly seeing warlike tactics used in broader cyber conflicts. Right? It used to be easy to tell the difference between war and non-war because there was a set of things that only could be done by nation states during war. Right? When you saw a tank, it meant war. Right? Or a bomber. Right? In cyberspace, you don't have that clean division. Right? You have tactics and weapons that used to be the purview of nation states being available to and used by non-nation state actors. So you see warlike circumstances in non-war situations. Right? Technology is spreading capability. And that makes policy difficult. Because that actually does blur the war-non-war distinction. It isn't just if I see a tank, it must be another country, we'll call the military. It's more complicated than that. So a couple of other examples of these sort of broader cyber conflicts. GhostNet, discovered in 09 in spring. This was a very large, very sophisticated surveillance network. It was arrayed against about 100 political, economic, media targets. China's to blame. And like pretty much all of these, we never know who did it. We just backfill the perpetrator from the victim list. You look at the victim list of GhostNet, and it's basically a who's who of who China wants to eavesdrop on. Right? So we assume China was behind it. July of 09, there was an attack against the United States and South Korea. So again, U.S. and South Korea are the victims. It must be North Korea who did it. Although if you... So that was again, denial of service attack. It's interesting that if you backtrack, I mean, there's some attempt to figure out where they came from, and it seems to have come from either China or London or Florida. Right? There was at least one lawmaker in the U.S. that wanted us to fire back kinetically against the perpetrators, which would have been awkward if it were Florida. January of last year, I guess also early this year, Google announced that they're the victims of a broad series of attacks that emanate from China. There's a lot of hacking coming from China. And you know, we presume that most of it is actually from China. Although if I was, you know, France wanting to hack, I would go through China. And those who watch China believe a lot of this is not state-sponsored, that it's more state-tolerated. So there are independent groups operating in China, and they know if they find something good, they pass it on to people above them, and in return, they get left alone. We also know that there is state-sponsored hacking coming from China. There were WikiLeaks cables about it. So we know China's complicated. Stuxnet, I think, is well worth talking about. Stuxnet is probably the first military-grade cyber weapon we've ever gotten our hands on. And this was an attack against Iranian nuclear capabilities. A lot of good investigative journalism says that the U.S. and Israel was behind it. You know, kind of obvious. You know, I sort of thinking about sort of these broad types of of cyber conflicts, I would definitely add the attacks we've seen around the U.S. elections in the past few cycles, whether it's attacking web servers on the eve of elections, either from candidates or from parties. We saw Sarah Palin's email hacked. There's a moral there about secret questions, which we'll save for another time. Last year in November in Burma, and what passes for elections in that country, there were cyber attacks associated with that. We can certainly talk about WikiLeaks and a lot of the political hacking associated there. Anonymous versus H.P. Gary, where we saw a loose group of people basically take down a company. We also learned that H.P. Gary was a cyber arms manufacturer. I didn't know we had any. We actually, if we had one, we have certainly have more than one. Two old examples I'll mention briefly. 1982, U.S. inserted a malicious code into Canadian software going to Russia for use on the Trans-Siberian pipeline. And the resultant explosion is actually still the largest non-nuclear explosion on the planet. 1991, this is widely believed. A lot of stuff is not confirmed. U.S. inserted malicious code into printers that went to Iraq, which helped disable air defense during the first Gulf War. So if you think about sort of this gamut of cyber threats, I mean, and I pick these because they're all non-financially motivated. Right? These are not criminal threats. These are politically motivated. You define politics as against governments, against institutions, against companies. I mean, they have some other motivation. There's a huge variety. And if you think about it, when you're attacked in cyberspace, there are a variety of institutions and frameworks you can call on for defense, right? The police, the military, Department of Homeland Security, a bunch of products and services you buy, your corporate lawyers. And who you call on when you're attacked depends on two things: who's attacking you and why. And in cyberspace, when you're attacked, the exact two things you don't know are who's attacking you and why. Right? That makes defense difficult. There isn't a clean division that you can see immediately between the military and a bunch of guys. I mean, 2 weeks ago, the hacking group Anonymous told NATO not to bug it. That's plain weird. Right? There's supposed to be some, you know, large separation between, you know, some hacker kids and NATO. Right? You know, and this is similar to, right, Al-Qaeda threatening America. Right? That's the sort of asymmetry we're dealing with here. It's much more extreme. And I think that's partially why you're seeing this kind of cyber war rhetoric. I mean, everyone's using the same tactics. I mean, think of the tactics in the examples, right? Data theft, eavesdropping, data manipulation, denial of service, sabotage. Right? That's the toolbox. And whether you're, you know, LulzSec or the Chinese military, that's your toolbox. So very different type of attack, very different legal framework, but at, you know, when you're at the receiving end, it looks the same. So a lot of this is the new buzzword APT, Advanced Persistent Threat. And I hate buzzwords, and I hated this one for a while, but I'm kind of coming around to it. That I think it's worth talking about these non-financially motivated attackers as a separate thing. Because normally in financial attacks, you just have to be more secure than the other guy. And as long as your bank is doing better than that bank, you're fine. But in a political attack, whether you're a country or, you know, a company in a politically charged industry, or, you know, Microsoft, a company everyone loves to hate, or Sony, a company everyone loves to make fun of this week, right? You know, people are going to work overtime to get into you. And unfortunately, right now on the internet, the attacker has the fundamental advantage. And this goes back and forth. I mean, you can think about the history of war. And as we had, you know, different technologies, advantages moved from attacker to defender. Right? The Civil War, you had a very strong attacker advantage just because weapons were so powerful. It really wasn't until Napoleon figured out how to reinvent tactics that switched. World War I, you had an extraordinarily strong defender advantage because of the way weapons were, and it took Hitler to invent blitzkrieg warfare and test it out in Spain before, you know, we figured out how to fight in that era. So it just goes back and forth over the decades. Right now on the internet, the attacker has the advantage. So there's a lot here in real. There's also a lot here in politics. And in a lot of ways, the politics worries me a lot more. The world is gearing up for cyber war. We are in the early years of a cyber war arms race. And, you know, we learned about last year that the U.S. Cyber Command is fully operational, whatever that means. You know, coming out of U.K., NATO, China, other countries, there's a lot of cyber war rhetoric. There's a lot of money being spent. And this really does have all the hallmarks and all the dangers of an arms race. And we saw the power struggle in the U.S. over who gets the budget and the power. It was mostly between the FBI and the DOD, with DHS also in there. And we know who won, right? The U.S. Cyber Command is co-located at Fort Meade with the NSA, and the general in charge of the U.S. Cyber Command is also general in charge of the NSA. So, you know, we know who won this power struggle. It's kind of obvious. It's a power struggle between government and free enterprise over securing a critical infrastructure. And this all, you know, falls into our privacy debates. And this is important, right? Because metaphors matter. You know, if we start using this war metaphor universally, a lot of things that we had a chance of winning, we just lose. Right? You know, to the police, we are citizens to protect. Right? To the military, we're a population to be subdued. Things work different in wartime. You know, war metaphor reinforces the notion that we're helpless, that we need the government to protect us, that we can't do it by ourselves, and that we should be fearful. I mean, war is something scary. And war changes the debate. War changes the solution space. Things you would never agree to in peacetime, you agree to in wartime because we're at war. Right. So, you know, we're seeing current debates about government in the U.S. and other countries, about government control over network defenses, over defending a national power grid, over protocols, over technologies. Right. That debate is different whether you assume peacetime or wartime. Right. The whole debate about wholesale surveillance. Right. In peacetime, if a government goes to AT&T and says, hey, we want to eavesdrop on everybody, AT&T says, stop, where's your warrant? Right? In wartime, AT&T says, use that closet over there, lock the door, and just put a do not disturb sign on it. Right? Because we're at war. And in fact, that's what happened because war on terror, you know, that's what people did. You know, it's not surprising. And if it's cyber war, that's what you're going to see again and again. Right? There's a debate on eavesdropping facilitation. So, I don't know the story. A number of years ago, the FBI complained to basically anybody who'd listen, we can't eavesdrop anymore on phone calls. Right? It used to be there were analog switches. We'd go to the phone company. We'd attach alligator clips to the right wires, and we'd sit there with our headset and listen. Now everything's digital. It's hard. This annoys us. We want this fixed. Right? And in fact, we had the CALEA law where the phone companies were supposed to make their switches eavesdropping friendly. Right? Fast forward to, you know, last year, a couple of years ago, FBI is saying this isn't good enough for us. A lot of the things you want to eavesdrop on are no longer on the phone lines. We need CALEA to apply to everything. Right? The real problem, of course, they have is Skype. So there's now a push for a CALEA extension to make all communications to be eavesdropping friendly. And you know, this ranges in difficulty from easy to impossible. I have something like Gmail, it's easy. Right? Your email exists in the clear on Google servers. So if the FBI wanted to eavesdrop, they'd serve a warrant on Google. I presume Google has an entire room full of attorneys to deal with all the international requests for data they must get every hour. And then Google will serve up whatever the warrant says. For something like Skype, it's impossible. I don't know if you know how Skype works, but your audio and video is end-to-end encrypted. It's encrypted on your computer, and it's decrypted on the computer of the person you're talking to. There actually is no way to make that system eavesdropping friendly other than to completely dismantle it and build another less useful system. You know, in various incarnations, what the FBI wants will also apply to chatting in Second Life and, I sometimes play Scrabble online and there's a little chat window you can talk to your opponent. I mean, that too would have to be made eavesdropping friendly. I mean, because it applies to everything. Now, we saw this debate last year with RIM in some other countries. And if you remember that both the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia said, hey, BlackBerries are annoying us because we can't eavesdrop on them. RIM said, well, we can't fix that. That's the way the system works. The governments of UAE and Saudi Arabia said, bullshit, you're doing it for Russia. India said, you got to do it for us too. And eventually the countries reached a compromise. We all know what that means, right? What happened was that RIM put RIM servers within those countries so they'd be subject to whatever laws and pressure the national governments could bring to bear on them instead of moving the data out of the country before decrypting it. I think we see this debate in some of the data retention laws showing up in a variety of countries, basically requiring ISPs to keep customer data of a varying degree of detail for a period of 1 year or 2 years in case the government might want to eavesdrop on it later. I think the cyberwar rhetoric matters a lot on the internet kill switch debate, which we've seen in recent months. Question is, should the president be able to shut off the internet? I'm not actually sure what that means. I kind of envision this big red button on Obama's desk. Stop the internet now. Right? And whether he should get that button, I think depends a lot on whether we are at a nation at peace or a nation at war. Or the debates about attribution. I think we're seeing increasing rhetoric about, all those anonymous people. I mean, not just anonymous, right, the group, but all those lowercase anonymous people on the internet. I mean, and it sounds compelling, right? If we just knew who you all were, if you did something bad, we'd know who did it. I mean, right, that sounds easy. I mean, technically it's impossible, but, this is something that's gaining more and more traction, that we should really curtail anonymity on the net. Right? And again, it sounds like something, if you're at war, is not unreasonable. Right? We do a lot of strange things at wartime. We tell Chrysler, stop making cars, start making tanks. We intern Japanese. Right? We do things we would never do in peacetime. And in fact, a lot of these things I just talked about will make us less safe in peacetime, right? Even though they might make sense in wartime. I mean, none of this. I mean to say that we should abandon the U.S. Cyber Command. War expands to fill all available theaters, and having a cyber command, I think, is just as essential as having a navy or a space command. And I like seeing the debate about who controls critical infrastructure. I think it's an important debate to have, and I think there are some serious market failures in critical infrastructure, simply because the value of the infrastructure is much greater to the nation than it is to the company that owns the piece. And there are also lots of interactions that fall through the cracks. So you're not going to get market solutions to some of these risks, especially some of these resiliency risks that I think are real important. I like to see more of a debate on the characteristics of cyber war. We're starting to see papers coming out of Naval War College and others, looking at what cyber war looks like. But I want to see more of that. Right? There is I talk about the fundamental asymmetry between attacker and defender. There's a terrain of cyberspace. Right? There are countries that are sort of naturally more resilient and naturally more vulnerable. You think of North Korea, where they have 7 computers in their country. Right? They're hard to attack in cyberspace. Right? The U.S., which is very, that we rely on cyberspace so much, we're sort of naturally more vulnerable. Right? We have a problem. This is also, I think, adds to some of the arms race, is that weapons don't come with a return address. I mean, there's a reason why. If you think about back to Syria, when Israel attacked the Syrian nuclear power plant, the Syrians can look up, you know, see the flag painted on the tail of the aircraft and know who did it. Right? When Iran gets attacked by Stuxnet, they don't know who did it. We didn't even know in the beginning if they were the target. And that's, you know, very destabilizing. I like to see talk on cyber war treaties. There's a book on cyber war by Richard Clark, which is called Cyber War, and I hesitate to recommend it. I think the first half is terrible. It's full of cyber war exaggerations. The second half is really good, because he talks a lot about cyber war treaties, similarities and differences from nuclear treaties, which international organizations might negotiate them, how you might verify them, which if you think about it, it's going to be really difficult. I think it's hard to hide a chemical weapons plant. I think how easy it is to hide a cyber weapons plant. But I certainly think these conversations are valuable. There is right now in the U.S., the U.S. government's blocking cyber war treaty efforts. I think we believe we have an advantage in cyberspace now. I want to keep it as long as possible. But I wouldn't mind seeing things like, you know, treaties on no first use, limiting collateral damage, not allowing unaimed weapons self-destructing the edge of the conflict. Stuxnet is well written in that regard. Stuxnet, I think it's April of 2012, will disappear. You know, they put in a self-destruct date into the worm. That feels like a good thing. I think we need good definitions of what an offensive action is in cyberspace. You know, we don't really know. And there's a gamut, right? And when we know that, you know, defending yourself isn't offensive, eavesdropping, you know, it's offensive, but it's not going to ever be an act of war. We've been doing it for millennia. And it's not going to change. Building up attack capabilities by stockpiling cyber weapons is likely going to be allowed. More problematic are some of these penetrations we're seeing. And the person who's, I think, done the most research on this is Seymour Hersh, writing for The New Yorker. And it seems like both the U.S. and China are actively penetrating each other's networks and in some cases, leaving backdoors and logic bombs to be used later. Now, this seems extraordinarily destabilizing. And his worry is that the decisions about these are being made, at least in the U.S., at much too low a level in the command structure. That it shouldn't be a colonel making decisions, it should be a general and possibly even the president. And if we are going to go into another country and leave a logic bomb, right, you know, there should be a very high level of approval of this. I know Richard Clark wrote an op-ed this week or last week about how China's doing that to us and how bad this is. You know, we're doing it to them, too. And I think it is bad. I mean, if some country, you know, snuck into Times Square and buried a bomb there in case they might need it later, we'd kind of get pissed off. I think we'd say, no, that's not allowed. You shouldn't be able to do that. Right. So, I mean, that holds true in cyberspace. And then there's offensive actions like Stuxnet, which I think by any reasonable definition is an act of war. You know, right now, acts of war are much more politically defined than functionally defined. So it's not going to be perceived as such. But, you know, Stuxnet really was no different than, Syria 2007. I mean, yes, one was planes, one was USB sticks. But the effects were the same. If one's an act of war, the other one is too. And this is why I really wasn't surprised or bothered by the Obama administration's statement a few weeks ago that they reserve the right to respond to cyber attacks with a non-cyber counterattack. I mean, that seems reasonable. I mean, what matters is the damage done, who did it, and why, not the attack vector. But even actually, you know, two more things. I think we haven't talked about and need to talk about commandeering. What happens in warfare is countries commandeer national assets for the war effort. And I assure you, if the U.S. is going to attack some other country in cyberspace, they're not going to use it for their networks at Fort Huachuca. They're going to use Google. They're going to use the big networks. They're going to commandeer them. And I'm sure that the United States military has had conversations with Google, with Amazon, with the U.S. backbone providers, with the big cyber guns in this country that can be turned into weapons. You know, what that means, I don't know. But, you know, in wartime, that is going to happen. I think we need to understand cyber mercenaries. You know, mercenaries kind of fell out of favor after Napoleon, and they seem to have come back. I mean, it's not just the contractors we're using in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's mercenaries in cyberspace as well. And there isn't really a modern warfare doctrine for mercenaries because they really haven't been an issue. And they are an issue now and will be. And I think we need to figure that out. And also figure out how to deal with these non-state actors. And, you know, as we're seeing this democratization of tactics, we are going to see warlike capabilities more and more used by non-nations. And whether it's, you know, kids playing politics or terrorists or anyone in between, you know, how the country and the world deals with them, I think is real important. But really for us, I mean, for us here today, what's important is the rhetoric. Right? That debates are being framed in terms of cyber war. The nation does not believe that the threat of cyber war is grossly exaggerated. That things like, you know, LulzSec and the hacking group that attacked Citicorp last week, or you know the probably military group that went after the RSA authentication tokens and then used that to break into Lockheed Martin, and actually who knows where else. That people are seeing these not in terms of crime, not in terms of peacetime espionage, but in terms of war. Right? And if that's the case, if people are seeing them in terms of war, and if lawmakers start seeing them in terms of war, we start losing a lot of debates. I mean, privacy is a luxury in wartime. It's a fundamental right in peacetime, but in wartime it's a luxury. And if we let them win the debate about war, we lose a lot of the debates about our rights. And it's fair, we sort of saw the debate take a turn when bin Laden was assassinated. Right? We could have said, you know, the guy is dead, we can all relax now. But instead we said, the guy is dead, oh my God, now we're even more scared. Right? That's not good. So, you know, I want us here to fight the war metaphor at every turn. Because the war metaphor, I think, is a very broad assault on the things we believe in this conference. And it affects everything we do, and it's going to really change the debate in the coming few years. There's a lot of money riding on this war metaphor. There's an enormous amount of money being made in cyber defense, cyber weapons, cyber war, and that money is going to push the threat and push the metaphor, and we have to push back. So I think that's it. I have a little time for questions, again, assuming the senator's not coming back. I don't know if you could vote and then come back, but okay. So it's a question way up there. Oh, hi.
About having been compromised. They're worried about something that looks an awful lot like the state actors with thinly veiled fronts coming after them every day. And for that subset of the world, it looks like military action coming after them day after day after day. And I don't think they're wrong about that.
I think it's certainly not. I mean, we know they're being attacked every day.
Right. And so whether or not cyber war is a good metaphor for all sorts of things from the rest of the economy, for the subset of people who either put on uniforms or work with people in uniforms, that's their daily reality, and they know they're behind, and they know that they've got all sorts of problems that are very challenging. So in order to win the overall rhetorical war, it seems like you need to have a way to acknowledge, even maybe more than you did in your brief mention of that in the speech today, what their reality is, and then draw some line between that and the way the rest of us live. How do you suggest we do that? Because they really are in military settings, fighting what seems like military threats.
I mean, they're fighting military threats, but they're not fighting wars. I mean, they're fighting, you know, peacetime invasions of their network. So it's more the Cold War kind of war. I mean, the threats are real. And I don't want to minimize the threats. And certainly, you know, military networks will need military defenders. But, you know, I don't believe that their reality is that they're currently at war. I mean, this is what peacetime looks like in cyberspace. I mean, if they were at war, I think they'd realize a difference. So, I mean, I think even there, I want to push back on the war rhetoric. I mean, yes, they're government threats. Yes, they're serious. Yes, the military has an enormous role in dealing with them, but I just don't see that as war. I mean, I want people coming home in body bags if there's war. I mean, I want actual war. I don't want this sort of metaphorical normal state to be war. So, you know, I even don't like using war there. Please. Well, the acoustics in the room is great.
Another place you were last year, Peter, was in Tallinn with me at the NATO COE conference. And if you recall, one of their debates was about this continuum between cybercrime, cyber terrorism, and cyber warfare. When Phil Reitinger started talking about the issue, now gone from DHS, last fall publicly during the administration's Internet Security Review, he said, we've got to get off this. And I think his point was, he wanted to achieve the same outcome you want to achieve, but for a different purpose. He wants us all to believe that the threat, the APT, will always be there, and the vocabulary, the choice of moniker of warfare or not warfare or response to terrorism or response to the threat, the semantics are irrelevant. The behavior and the bureaucratic institutions of government and the threats to civil liberties that those institutions will instantiate in order to achieve their bureaucratic objectives are the larger concern that I think we have. Maybe it doesn't matter what we call it. The point is what its presence in our civil life does to the fabric of rule of law.
You know, I mean, I think as technologists, you know, it doesn't matter what we call it, but I think in policy it matters a lot. I think it changes the debate dramatically. It changes what you're willing to give up, what you're willing to accept. So I think words are really powerful here. And it's this collision of this rhetorical war like the war on crime with actual warfare. And what we're talking about kind of has pieces of both. So you know, as soon as it's war, you know, it's the DOD that deals with it, not the FBI. Okay? And that alone means all the, you know, legal protections we have, as you know, as weak as they are, against the FBI abusing its power, no longer exist. I mean, so that itself, you know, which agency is in charge of defense makes a huge difference. And I think it'll definitely make a huge difference in debates going forward.
So, Bruce, let me take you...
Yeah, you first. Yeah, I saw you first.
Let me take you up stack and go to the other end of the spectrum. So then, if this stuff that's going on isn't cyber war, and I agree with you on that, and I think Howard Schmidt agrees with you on that, mm-hmm. The term is used far too loosely. What would nation state on nation state or its near actors, full-blown cyber war look like in your mind, and what would it be its consequences around the world and with society if we were having a World War III in cyberspace and compare it to what's going on now?
You know, I'm not convinced there would be a. I tend not to like these questions because it asks people to talk about the worst case. When you talk about the worst case, that's all anybody will ever think about. So I always tend to duck these. But, you know, in general, you could certainly imagine, just like, you know, when we invaded Iraq, there's an air war preceding a ground war. And the next time, you'll probably see a cyber war preceding an air war preceding a ground war. Because those are the more standoffish theaters until before you put people in actual harm's way. I think an actual cyber war will look something like Stuxnet, only a lot more of it. You know, physical damage done to warfighting capability, to infrastructure, by weapons delivered in cyberspace, as opposed to, you know, what we're used to, by weapons delivered by air. So I think warfare looks mostly the same, but it really is just the attack vector that starts changing.
So if I can follow up on that, if we change the word instead of cyber war to information warfare, very little of this is new to the Pentagon and its friends, right?
I don't think it is. Right. And I think, and information warfare is also, an ill-advised choice of terms because it's actually information peacetime, right? It's information steady-state problems as opposed to information warfare, which is, you go into war, you fight it, and then you leave it. I mean, it's like a hurricane threat. It comes and then it goes, as opposed to the steady state. Please.
Hey, Jay Stanley, ACLU. So, as you said, one of the operative dynamics here is that attackers have a systematic advantage over defenders in this realm. Do you have any opinions or thoughts about whether that's likely to remain true over the long term? Is there a dynamic here in which we'll bring that to an end? For example, as defenders sort of get better, and to what degree is this sort of a result of technical issues, such as encryption or whatever? And to what extent is it a result of policy issues, such as liability and cost shifting by companies and so forth? Do you have any thoughts on sort of how this is likely to play out? Because I mean, it has big policy implications if it's something that's sort of inevitable and hard built in. Versus, something that can be fixed by policy and by getting corporate security.
So I don't think it's policy. I think it is technical. I think technically there's a fundamental advantage to the attacker in cyberspace. Of course it'll change. You said over long term. That gives me my grayed out. Yes, it'll change long term. The question is when. I mean, I don't think we know. I mean, you go look at the history of warfare. It could take 50 years. It could 100 years. It could take 20 years. I mean, right now, as scientists, we don't know how to build secure systems. We just don't know, and everything we do, it's a lot more art than science. I mean, yes, we can do way better than we are, and that's economic, right? I mean, the amount of safety and security that goes into the software that on an airplane or the space shuttle is just orders of magnitude more expensive and more extensive than what goes into Microsoft Office. So we could do better technically, but the economics doesn't support it. But even there, I mean, there is just so many ways into a system and no way to build a system that is secure. I mean, we're really better off working on resilience than bulletproofing systems, that building fail-safes, fail-secure modes, backup systems, ways to get up quickly after an attack, that those sort of mechanisms are going to give us more security, more safety in near term. I mean, and that really only works against attacks against infrastructure. It doesn't work against, let's say, attacks against privacy. Because, if Citibank can get their network up and running again, doesn't make their credit card numbers less stolen? But even there are ways you can build more resilience into the credit card system that it could say, we no longer care about the secrecy of these numbers. So those sorts of mechanisms, I think, are going to be more fruitful. But, I think it's going to be a long time before the pendulum shifts to Defender, that we need some kind of comprehensive theory of Internet security, and we just don't have that.
Building on your idea of Google as the big gun and the World War II when industrialists were drafted into service for the war, I'm picturing Mark Zuckerberg as the minister of psyops in cyberspace. But that that disturbing image aside, Eisenhower...
You want a like button on the war and a dislike button for the enemy, that kind of thing?
Yeah. Exactly. But I'm wondering, Eisenhower warned us about the military-industrial complex coming out of that conflict. It seems to me you're positing an information-industrial complex whose interest is served by these heightened exaggerations of warfare. And aside from the technological aspects that we've talked about, what are your policy prescriptions for building firewalls between that information industry and the triggers and the levers that lead to cyber war?
You know, I don't know, and I want people who are better at me than political scientists are thinking about that. I think, you know, we've talked about the surveillance-industrial complex, and we are seeing that, you know, whether it's cameras or ID cards or surveillance databases being pushed into places where they haven't been because the technology exists and the companies are trying to sell it. I read last week that the full-body scanner manufacturers want to get their stuff into stadiums because, right, they have them, they built them, they're trying to find new markets for them. So, yeah, I think there definitely is this cyber military industrial complex. There's a lot of companies making big money on cyber war. I mean, there's a reason that Mike McConnell exaggerates a cyber war threat. I mean, it directly affects his bonuses. I mean, there's a reason Richard Clark does the same thing. And there's a lot of money, there's a lot of power in exaggerating the threat. And yes, that does worry me. And I think this is going to self-perpetuate in the same way the military industrial complex, you know, controlled a lot of 60s, 70s, 80s. Jim.
Just wanted to see if you would address cyber terrorism along the same lines. The capacity of attacks to complete that exercise in terms of terrorism, and maybe compare the number of cyber terrorists in and around the U.S. government to the number out in the wild.
So I kind of think the cyber terrorist threat is really vastly overblown. That there isn't a lot you can do as a terrorist in cyberspace. And you talk to people who worry about threat, and they talk about, you know, communication satellites being taken out. I mean, that's not terrorism. And, you know, these things happen, right? Occasionally, there's a software upgrade goes bad, and a communication satellite disappears for a few hours, or there's a blackout, and the entire Northeast Quadrant of the United States goes dark. And, you know, these are annoying. These are expensive. Perhaps they're vacations for you. Right? This isn't terrorism. And you know, looking around at what actual, you know, physical malicious things have been done, it's one example of a hacker breaking into a sewage treatment plant in Australia and dumping quite a lot of raw sewage into a bay. Near as we can tell, he didn't do it on purpose, probably couldn't have done it on a bet. This isn't terrorism. I think the terrorist risks from actual physical attacks are much, much greater. I mean, even though, yes, occasionally we have 911 services routed through the internet, and they will go down if there's an internet outage, and they go down, you know, during blackouts, it still doesn't really rise to terrorism to me. This is going to change. You know, more infrastructure goes online, more SCADA vulnerabilities, more of this becomes public, and there will become a time when, you know, an actor like a terrorist can cause physical harm in cyberspace. I think largely at this point, it's a medium, if nothing, I'm really worrying about. And with that, I have to get off stage. Thank you very much.